On this 19th day of July, 2006, we're reading from Srimad Bhagavad Gita as it is, translation and commentary by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Chapter 1, Observing the Armies on the Battlefield of Kurukshetra, texts 37 to 38, probably page 59, 137, 38. Yadyapyate na pasyanti lobo pahata chetasa kulakshaya kutam dosham mitra drohe chapatakam katam na geyam asmabhi papat asman nivartitum Kulakshaya kutam dosham. Papashyad bir janardana. O Janardan, although these men, their hearts overtaken by greed, see no fault in killing one's family or quarreling with friends, why should we, who can see the crime in destroying a family, engage in these acts of sin? Purport. A Kshatriya is not supposed to refuse to battle or gamble when he is so invited by some rival party. Under such an obligation, Arjun could not refuse to fight because he had been challenged by the party of Duryodhana. In this connection, Arjun considered that the other party might be blind to the effects of such a challenge. Arjun, however, could see the evil consequences and could not accept the challenge. Obligation is actually binding when the effect is good, but when the effect is otherwise, then no one can be bound. Considering all these pros and cons, Arjun decided not to fight. Om Ajnana Tamarandasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmidatam Mena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my humble obeisances unto him. So, Arjun here, the point is being made that he's deviating from the real dharma of a kshatriya. A kshatriya has this kind of code of behavior. When he's challenged to a battle or to a gambling match, then he has to accept. This was one of the reasons why there was so much trouble, because Yudhishthira was challenged to a gambling match by Duryodhana. And Duryodhana had on his side this very skilled gambler named Shakuni. And Shakuni was a cheater in this game. They had kind of a dice game. When you see that when you read that they played dice, it was explained to me once by Gopi Puranadana Prabhu, that it's almost like a Parcheesi game. You ever play Parcheesi? Probably not. You did, because you're of a certain age. But Parcheesi has probably gone the way of Monopoly. It's a game where you throw kind of dice and then you move a little piece around a board. Yeah, Parcheesi. So that was what they were playing. A similar game to that. But Shakuni was a cheater. He was skilled at cheating. So Yudhishthira kept losing and losing, but still he was playing and playing because he was Dharma personified, even though challenged. Even though cheated, because the challenge was there, he kept playing until he lost everything. So, and here, the Arjun is being challenged to fight, but he's declining. He's declining to fight because he sees the evil effects that will occur from the fight. And so he doesn't want to have any part of it. He's on the material side, he's right. This whole dynasty is going to be killed. His friends, his family, his guru, everyone's going to be killed. So from an emotional standpoint, he might be what you would call today a conscientious objector. A conscientious objector. That this battle looked from the superficially is very evil. As better to just give in. But the one problem was that Krishna had planned it all out. And that the battle had a higher purpose, which was to reinstall real dharma in the world. And so Arjun was acting on his whims here, but he's making a nice argument. You see, he's going to continue to make this argument on various grounds. And from one point of view, they look very reasonable. But we'll see as the Bhagavad Gita goes on that they're not. Kulakshaye punashyanti kula dharma sanatana. Notice the word dharma comes in again. Dharma nashti kulam krishnam adharmo bibhavat yuta. Three times in this verse the word dharma is there. Twice positively, one negatively. With the destruction of the dynasty, the eternal family tradition is vanquished, and thus the rest of the family becomes involved in irreligion. Purport. In the system of the Varnashram institution, there are many principles of religious traditions to help members of the family grow properly and attain spiritual values. The elder members are responsible for such purifying processes in the family, beginning from birth to death. But on the death of the elder members, such family traditions of purification may stop, and the remaining younger family members may develop irreligious habits and thereby lose their chance for spiritual salvation. Therefore, for no purpose should the elder members of the family be slain. So it's understood that in this battle, there were various old, what you would call today, war horses. You know, there were older men who were also on the battlefield. They didn't want to miss this. And just like Bhishma, he was the senior of all, and he was a great general. And not only was he a great fighter, but he knew all of the intricacies of arranging the army. And, you know, there's a lot of science in this art of war. So if they're all wiped out, what's going to happen to the younger generation? In every culture, it's always the elders who pass on the traditions to the youngers. If suddenly there's a decapitation, if you will, and what are the youngers going to do? You know, so this is a very important point Arjuna is making here, that there will be chaos if the knowledge and tradition and culture is not passed on by the elders. Of course, again, the exception here is that Krishna, he's the oldest of the oldest. Govindamadi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami, says Lord Brahma. He's the Adi Purusham. In this Bhagavad Gita, he also says, Pitaham Asya Jagato. I am the grandfather, or I am the father and also the grandfather of everyone. So the real tradition resides in the heart of the Lord. And he is the real enunciator of Dharma. This, again, Arjuna is pleading the argument of Dharma. He didn't want to destroy Dharma. So everything keys on what is Dharma. In the Bhagavatam, we find, it says, Dharmam tu sakshat bhagavat pranitam. That real Dharma is that which is enunciated by Bhagavan himself. And then, there's a certain repository of that Dharma in human society. And it's commonly said to be reposed in the Mahajans. Now, what does Mahajan mean? Jana means person, Maha means great, in these great persons. And there are 12. There are said to be 12. It is said, Swayambhu, Narada Shambhu, Komara Kapilo Manu, Prahlado Janago Bhishma, Bali Vayasaki Vayam. This verse comes in the next verse. It's spoken by Daksha, I believe. So, who are these personalities? Swayambhu. Now, Swayambhu could be mistaken for Swayambhu Vamanu, because he has the same name. But here, Swayambhu means one who is self-born. So, who is the self-born one? Who can guess? Who? Brahma. No, Brahma. Brahma himself, Brahma, Lord Brahma. Brahma is the first repository of this knowledge. We belong to the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. He is the head of our Sampradaya. He received the knowledge from Krishna directly. So Brahma is certainly the repository of the truth. Swayambhu, Narada, Shambhu, Narada Muni. Now all of these personalities that we're going to mention here, they come on the stage of the Bhagavatam, if you will, and they make their statement. They have a certain series of instructions that are all valuable. And the one who's most prominent of all among them, in terms of giving instructions, is Narada Muni. Narada Muni comes again and again. Every canto he appears and gives these instructions. But Swayambhu Narada Shambhu. Who is Shambhu?
Lord Shiva.
Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva also has his own sampradaya, known as the Rudra sampradaya. Lord Shiva, is known as the greatest Vaishnava, Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu. And Komara, now here this four personalities are known as in one to one name, the four Kumaras. They also have their own sampradaya. They appear especially in the fourth canto to teach Maharaj Prithu. Wonderful instructions they give to the King Prithu. Kapila, Kapila Muni, or Kapila Dev, Lord Kapila Dev, third canto of Bhagavatam. He gives his instructions to his mother, and they're very wonderful instructions. He describes the creation in great detail, and he describes the glories of devotional service, the wanderings of the living entities. And he describes the life of the embryo in the womb. Quite remarkable. I always wondered at this because it describes how it's first this little like blastula, and then it, you know, like that. And how do they know that? You know, it's great. It's a wonderful section. And then here Manu is Swayambhuva Manu. He also is one of the Mahajans. And he comes in the eighth canto? No, I'm sorry. Yes, I think it's the eighth canto. And he speaks something that sounds just like the Isha Upanishad. Some of the verses are almost identical. Om Pur Namadak Pur Namidam. It's quite remarkable. And then we have Bali. Yeah. Kapilomanu, Bali Vayasativayam. Bali Maharaj doesn't give so many instructions, but he serves as a great example of complete surrender. Who did he surrender to? The small. Yes, Lord Vamanadev. Now, just a little editorial note. He's known as a dwarf Brahmin. Now, we went through this. If you have the hyphen there, dwarf Brahmin, that means the dwarf is used as a noun. We don't consider Vamana a dwarf. In English, a dwarf is someone who's misshapen, who's, you know, not fully there. You know, dwarf is not good. But dwarf as an adjective simply means small. So never use the hyphen. If you have to, huh? He was miniature. He was small. He was miniature, small. Understand what I'm saying? Anyway, he was a little Brahmin how did he interact with Bali? Remember the story? Madhu, you've been around a while. Can't remember. Okay.
He was given a gift of three steps of the universe. No, three steps, period. The three steps, he can have that much land.
Right.
But he didn't know that he was God also, so he took three steps, and I think the last one was on his head.
Very good. Okay, so yeah, this is a wonderful scene. So Vamanadev comes. Yes. Yeah, you got it. Good. Pretty much got all the detail. So Vamanadev, now I have to say, Vamanadev is also known as Upendra, means an Upa Indra. He was Indra's brother. He was also the son of Aditi. Now you have the sons of Diti and the sons of Aditi. The sons of Diti are demons. They're known as Daityas. The first sons of Diti, Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha. And then Aditi gave birth to the demigods, chief of whom was Indra. So then the younger brother of Indra was Upa Indra or Upendra or Vamanadev. So he's known as Upendra. And he was born to Aditi after she performed the sacrifice, Payavratam. And then he goes to Bali. Bali had captured the universe. He was the grandson of Prahlad, was Bali. And so he was born in the Daitya family, and therefore he was playing as a demon, but inside he was a great devotee. Prahlad didn't even play as a demon. He was always a devotee. But Bali played his role of a demon for a while, and he took over the heavenly planets for the demons, or the daityas. So then, Aditi, you know, the mother of the demigods, she wanted to get the kingdom back for her sons, you know, for her, you know. So this was her plan. She prayed to have God as her son so that he could recapture the kingdom. So this is how he chose to do it. he approached as a little brahmachari, you know, perfect, beautiful brahmachari. God is always beautiful. So he's very attractive. So he's coming into this sacrifice. This is told in the eighth canto. And Bali's performing his big sacrifice. And he has this guru, the same guru that Prahlad had, Shukracharya. You know, it means that he's a materialistic guru. You know, he's calculating, how can Bali, you know, control as much as possible so my salary will increase, so I'll have security. And that's what he... But he eventually also became a great devotee, but at this point he was calculating. So he comes into the arena, and any Brahmachari comes in, you're supposed to give charity. You know, this is the idea. They depend on charity. This is what they do. Brahmacharis go around and beg. So Bali immediately was taken with his effulgence and his beauty, and he wanted to offer him a gift. So he did offer him a gift. And Shukracharya said, wait, you know, don't. It's actually Vishnu. So take everything. Don't do it, you know. You said, but you didn't say om, therefore it is a technicality, you can take it back, you know, like that. He was doing like that. Isn't there something like that? I forget the details. So now Bali had this critical decision to make. See, just like Arjun, there's always this critical decision all of us have to make. And Bali, being a great devotee, you know, he makes the right decision. But here, he has to make the decision. Shall I follow my guru, even though he's a materialistic guru, but he's my teacher? Or shall I do what is right, dharma, and give charity to this Brahmin? You know, so he has to make the decision. He says, okay, I'm going to follow through and offer him whatever he wants. So he begs 3 steps of land. And he's just a little boy. He's not even just a little boy. He's a special miniature. So 3 steps of land. Bali has the whole universe. He says, why you just beg 3 steps of land? I can give you a whole planet. You know? So Vamana says, no, I'm a Brahmin. If a Brahmin should be satisfied with minimal. You know, if I started getting into accumulating wealth, then I would lose my brahminical power. You know, he's preaching to Bali, you know, not to be greedy himself. So Bali says, okay, whatever you want. So then what happens is that he kind of expands. He starts expanding. And his first step, he covers the whole world. His next step, he covers the whole universe and pierces through the covering of the universe. You remember I was explaining this morning, I think it was this morning, yeah, that the universe is covered by these 8 coverings, first of which is Earth. Then earth, water, fire, air, ether, enormous coverings, billions of miles wide. So he pierces through it. He's so expansive, you know. And what comes through, as you mentioned, a little few drops from the causal ocean, spiritual ocean out there, in which Mahavishnu was lying, Karana ocean. And those drops of the causal ocean leaking through that barrier are the Ganges. Eventually it comes down through the heavenly planets and onto the earth. But it's washing the foot dust from the toes of Vamana. And therefore, it picks up this spiritual quality. So the Ganges is always potent to relieve sins. You take a bath in the Ganges, you relieve all your sins. And it's always antiseptic. It's never polluted. This is actually, they've tested it. So anyway, then he has no room for the third step. He's already covered the whole universe. So now Bali, you know, realizes he's dealing with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So then Vamana says, where am I going to put my third step? He says, oh, you put it on my head. In other words, I surrender, you know, to you. So this was the greatness of Bali. He had everything and he gave everything. He had everything, he gave it all to Krishna. So it's called Atma Nivedanam. This is the Atma Nivedanam, the donation of all. So this is how the Bhagavatam teaches Dharma. This is Dharma again. You know, Bali followed the supreme Dharma. So Bali, Vyasaki Vayam. Bali was the 10th. The 11th was Vyasaki. That's Shukadeva Goswami. Now he speaks throughout the Bhagavatam. And he has his own instructions too, especially in second canto to Parikkhit. And then Vayam. You know who Vayam is? The 12th? Yamaraj. Actually, Yamaraj is giving these instructions. Forgive me. Yamaraj is the 12th of the Mahajans. He's Dharma personified. So this Dharma is reposed, if you will, within these 12 Mahajans. And what they speak and what they teach provide guidance for all of us, for all humanity. So Arjuna, now of course all of it originally comes from Krishna, the knowledge. So Arjuna is directly going to hear from Krishna. But at this point, he's displaying his confusion about real Dharma. Although he's arguing on the basis of Dharma, he's actually speaking adharma. And this is part of the lesson here. So any questions about these points? Yes?
You said that the Brahma, the head of the Sampradaya, that he received knowledge from who? Krishna? Which one?
Lord Brahma received knowledge directly from Krishna in the heart.
All right. And then also, that little Brahmin, was he just little or was he a child?
He was a child, but he was also miniature. He was short for his age. Let's put it that way. The dwarf Brahmin is small. Okay. Next verse. Now, this next one is one of the verses that Prabhupada would also always quote. This is kind of the culmination of Arjuna's argument here. Adharma babavat Krishna pradushyanti kulastriya. Strishu dushtashu varshneya jayate varna sankaraha. When irreligion is prominent in the family, O Krishna, the women of the family become polluted, and from the degradation of womanhood, O descendant of Vrishni, comes unwanted progeny. Now, there's some confusion about this. Anyway, we'll go through the purport. Good population in human society is the basic principle for peace, prosperity, and spiritual progress in life. The Varnashram religion's principles were so designed that the good population would prevail in society for the general spiritual progress of state and community. Such population depends on the chastity and faithfulness of its womanhood. As children are very prone to be misled, women are similarly very prone to degradation. Therefore, both children and women require protection by the elder members of the family. By being engaged in various religious practices, women will not be misled into adultery. According to Charanaka Pandit, women are generally not very intelligent and therefore not trustworthy. But this doesn't pertain to Vaishnava women. They're the most trustworthy and most intelligent. There you go. So the different family among women, they're the most trustworthy and intelligent. So the different family traditions of religious activity should always engage them. And thus their chastity and devotion will give birth to a good population eligible for participating in the Varnashram system. On the failure of such Varnashram Dharma, naturally the women become free to act and mix with men, and thus adultery is indulged in at the risk of unwanted population. Irresponsible men also provoke adultery in society, and thus unwanted children flood the human race at the risk of war and pestilence. And I think that we can kind of see that now. Isn't it? There's so much confusion. Now, this idea of unwanted progeny, some devotees, I think, had the misapprehension, and this means that, oh, like, you know, you get pregnant by accident and they're unwanted children. But really what this means, not is that, but that these children growing up are unwanted in society. They become sources of great disturbance, especially when you have all of this broken family business. We can see that everywhere. You deal with it every day, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. And, you know, a social worker. Yeah. So this is a very critical point, that in a sane society, the family is a very important unit. And the key element of the family is, you know, the proper environment for children. So women need to be protected, and their chastity needs to be protected, and so forth. And, you know, a society that does not protect Brahmins, gentle intellectuals, women, children, old men, the helpless, is truly a demonic society and is hellish. And so much sin is incurred just by, you know, seeing these things happen and not trying to remedy them. By practicing Krishna consciousness, trying to spread this knowledge, we're trying in our own way to remedy the situation. It is truly the only way that can be remedied, by reformation. Through knowledge and through cultivating higher sentiments and higher qualities of life. It's not, there's no, you know, I mean, in my lifetime, you know, I've seen the welfare state, you know, and how, of course, you have these helpless children and women who need protection or need some kind of sustenance. So you have to have, you know, the government give them something. But it also, and it's true, you know, that can also cultivate a culture of dependence, that there's no responsibility. We'll just have children, and in this way, we'll get our welfare check and, you know, sit back and enjoy. There's also that tendency. So it's not some material adjustment that's going to help this thing. It's a culture of knowledge and a whole propagation of real Dharma. And so Arjun was foreseeing this. This was foreseen before the age of Kali began. If you read the Bhagavatam, when the Bhagavatam is spoken at the cusp of the Dwapara Yuga and the Kali Yuga, basically. After Krishna had disappeared and Mahaparikrit, you know, was sitting down. You know, he was the first king in the Kali Yuga. So he was really holding back the Kali Yuga by his strong leadership as a Vaishnava. But then he was cursed by a Brahmin boy named Sringi. And this was the beginning of the degradation of the Brahminical culture, misusing that power. So there's a wonderful, I keep calling it soliloquies, because this is what they remind me of, little speeches by, you know, leading figures in the Bhagavatam that are very worth meditating on. And the father of Sringi, Shamika Rishi, I think his name was. Isn't it? Shamika. No, that's a different one. Shamika was the father of Sringi. He was the one who got the snake on his neck by Parikit when he was out in the forest. So when he heard that his son had cursed Parikit, he was heartbroken. You know, Parikit was much beloved by everybody. He was ruling nicely and keeping everything together. And now his son had, you know, cursed him, and the curse could not be taken back. So he then used his mystic power to foresee some of the degradation that would take place due to this Parikit's being absent from the scene and the advent of Kali Yuga. And he's describing what Arjuna is afraid of, you know, that people would become like monkeys, that they would simply be controlled by their senses, that families would be destroyed. You know, he was seeing that, and it comes in more detail in the 12th canto. It's quite remarkable. Where in the 12th canto, predictions for the age of Kali. You know, Prabhupada always focused on because when he came in the 60s, the hippie era was in its height, you know, just starting. And, you know, the fashion was guys were wearing their hair long, you know, even today I think some of them do that. So he said, men will think they look very beautiful by wearing long hairs, you know, and he actually saw that manifested before his eyes when he came to America. But you can buy, you know, there won't be any justice. If you can buy off the judge, there'll be justice. How much do we see of that today? If you have a good lawyer, you know, the perfect example, you know, in history, recent history is the, what's his name? God, the football player who was acquitted. What is it? O.J. Simpson. I mean, what a farce, you know, that was it. But it's more, you know, happens every day. You got, you know, these big guys, especially business world, where you have these business deals and you're cheating and you buy off the judge or you get off with him. So anyway, the Kali Yuga is in full swing now, no doubt about it. And the only thing that can provide a countervailing force for the age of Kali is the Sankirtan movement. The Sankirtan movement, the congregational chanting of the holy name. And indeed, it is predicted there will be a 10,000-year golden age, yes, within the Kali Yuga of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. So we're at the beginning of that, you know, 500 years into it. So it's hard to see how it's going to take over the world right now, but certainly no one could have predicted what Prabhupada did in a few short years. So it's been about 40 years now, almost exactly 40 years. In fact, yesterday was the 40th anniversary. Yeah, July 18th was the 40th anniversary of the founding of ISKCON. The actual day was yesterday. So we're 40 years in now, and the holy name, as it is said, Rajate Sakalopari, in that Kubalastika, I think it's called Kubalastika, that the holy name is reigns supreme everywhere. It makes this world appear like bits of straw upon the ground. It makes his world appear like bits of straw upon the ground. It splendorously reigns supreme, divinity and sound. So the holy name is actually all-powerful because it's Krishna. And when chanted purely, it has a very powerful effect on ourselves and also whoever hears it. So this propagation of the holy name and the knowledge of the books will go on. We just have to decide whether we're going to be part of it or not, and we'll ultimately prevail. So we have time for one or two more questions, and then we can adjourn. Yes, I do not mind. Yes.
I was coming back, and they were destroyed. I think they're like Jewish missionaries, you know, like Mormon missionaries. I actually noticed to get them, you know. They wear the political columns in the front, it's like a Brahmin thread, you know.
Yes, yes. What do they call those things?
Tzitzis.
The tzitzis.
Yeah, they were wearing it. They were wearing yarmulkes, and they spoke to me. I told them, they said, "Oh, you're Jewish, right? You're Jewish, right? Oh, yeah. Your mother's Jewish. Mother. Mm-hmm. He said, and immediately they just started saying to me, come here. He had like a little notepad or something there. He said, you want to put on the, I forget the name, but...
They wanted to tie the little thing around you?
Collectory. You want to put it on? So I tried to say to him, you know, what's more important is chanting of God's name. They just couldn't get it, you know. They were like almost like trying to convert me to put
them on this plane. Oh, no, it's not that. They saw you as a wayward Jew. Yeah. They wanted to bring you back.
What I'm actually noticing, it seems to that they do have a sort of like a missionary spirit now, too. Starting now,
but they're not trying to convert, right?
I don't know what to do.
No, they don't. They tried it.
But that's a Jew for Jesus.
No.
These guys. Yeah, no, Orthodox. No, they it's not that they're trying. They're missionary. They don't do that, right? I mean, you don't go around trying to create Jews, new Jews. They try to keep the old Jews. That's the big thing. Yeah. But the thing is, listen, Maru. I mean, you're out there all the time. If you run into Jews, you just got to look at the Psalms of David, the Old Testament. It says right there. What do you mean can't get it? It's their Torah. You tell them you find to follow the Torah. It says, play the cymbals and glorify the name of God. Right there in the Torah.
Yeah,
you tell, isn't it?
Yeah.
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 No, forget it. You quote the Psalms of David, you completely blow them away. Back to Chris.
So we got 9,500 years of golden age left,
right? Right.
And after that is the rest of 300 some thousand years.
It's actually 417,000.
So, what's the point, you know? Like, if it's all just going to go downhill at the end of this,
Well, the point is that so many souls can be saved in the interim. In other words, there's billions of souls who can be saved.
So, ISKCON or whatever, the Brahmins are going to rule the world, essentially?
The Vaishnavs. The Vaishnavs. Within that time period, the Sankirtan movement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, how it's going to happen, or how it's going to, the details, who can say? But, I mean, you know, you can kind of visualize whole stadiums full of people chanting Hare Krishna, how powerful that would be. You know, we've actually had that, some of that, you know, it's quite overwhelming. You know, you can easily see, yeah, the power is there, you know. So, yeah. Yes?
Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, I'm just saying, yes, it will go on for 10,000 years, and after that, I mean, I don't think it'll be like falling off a cliff. There's got to be a little bit of a decline, you know, declining curve. Yes, it is said that it will increase and become prevalent throughout the world. So.
Okay, so why are we then what's the point of this transmigration of the soul through body and body and body if it's all just going downhill anyway? Is it going to come back again, and which... You know, you have said before, and if we're going back to Godhead, if the Brahmins are going to rule the world, and and hopefully everybody's going to be a Vaishnava, why are we doing this?
Well, the point is that it's going to happen, but the way it happens is through the efforts of the devotees, just like on the battlefield. You know, the battle was already won. In chapter 11, Krishna shows Arjuna that all of the enemies are already being killed, but I still want you to fight. I want you to be the agent. I want you to take the credit, so to speak. In other words, we as individuals, even though we should have confidence that this is going to happen, we're just at the beginning. Personally, we may not see that 10,000 years. We may be back to Godhead. We should be back to Godhead. But, I mean, as far as transmigration goes, I don't understand. I mean, the purpose is of bhakti, you know, yoga, is to end the transmigration individually for ourselves. So, I mean, a scenario could be that, okay, in our lifetime, we'll encourage so many people to take up the chanting, but many of them won't go back to Godhead. Maybe we won't get back to Godhead in one lifetime.
So, will after this, after the destruction, then what?
After the destruction of the universe? Well, you have to understand that that there's no destruction, you know, of the universe. What happens is that society goes on in a degraded form, and practically, you know, everyone's degraded, and there's a lot of demonic rulers around taking advantage of the poor people, and it's very, you know, miserable. And then Kalki comes, and he annihilates all these rulers, the demonic rulers, and reinstates the Brahminical class. And there's another Sati Yuga that comes out of that. You know, it's almost like, think of it like this, like, you know how entropy increases? Entropy is disorganization. It's almost like a house, you know. If you just live in it and you don't never clean it, never straighten up, eventually it becomes totally disorganized. And eventually somebody with a little bit of smarts or, you know, motor goodness has to come in and say, okay, let's do a big overhaul and just get it back into shape. You know, we're going to paint the floors, rip up it. And then? A bug, okay. And then, you know, overhauls the house and then it's straight and it's cool and it's in mode of goodness-y again. So that's what happens. Over time, Krishna says in time, by the force of time, the science as it is becomes lost. So there's this 10,000-year blip because this is a special Kali Yuga. This is a special Kali Yuga because Lord Chaitanya has come. After Krishna, Krishna comes and Lord Chaitanya comes. Krishna comes in the end of Dwapara Yuga, then Lord Chaitanya comes. Once in a day of Brahma, there's 1,000 cycles through where Krishna doesn't come personally, and where Lord Chaitanya doesn't come. Here we're sitting here in that fortunate Kali Yuga where Lord Chaitanya has actually come to teach the process of the holy name, the chanting. So how fortunate we are. So we should take part fully, hopefully go back to Godhead, maybe one or two lifetimes it'll take. You know, there's no loss or diminution. Whatever progress you make here, you'll go start there next lifetime. So hopefully one or two, three lifetimes, it's nothing. Go back to Godhead, and in the meanwhile, help the propagation so that gradually the whole world becomes Krishna conscious. But then, due to the force of time, after 10,000 years, it'll start degrading and then all the way downhill till the end of 432,000 years, Kalki comes, starts the whole thing over again for the next Kali Yuga. That's the scenario for us. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.
So make sure that little bug's not in your book bag.
Okay.